Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, and today I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, here at the SHOT Show, and I'm hanging out with Ryan Callahan and the Meat Eater crew, as always, and my friend, longtime friend, Ian Harrison, who is currently the editor-in-chief of Recoil Magazine, which is a one of the better gun magazines out in the world. It's on newsstands, and you're able to subscribe to it as well. I believe they'll mail it to you. It's a great conversation. Ian has an incredible background when it comes to firearms ownership. His perspective is a unique one, and you'll find out why in this podcast. We delved into some of the more political discussions we've had in the past that can be, I will warn you, they can fire folks up. Everyone will have their opinions about our discussion. But I think what, as always, we try to do is to examine these things. And don't be afraid to wade into tough issues and examine them with pragmatism and a careful nature. So hopefully you'll agree with that as you listen to episode number 47 with Ian Harrison. Hi, Ian.
Hello, Ben.
How are you?
I'm fine and dandy. I mean, how better could I be? I mean, I'm hooked up to an IV.
I know. Me too. And Callahan's here. Hey, Cal.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm a what do you call it? A non-combatant here.
Non-combatant.
Callahan is not hooked up to an IV.
I'm an observer.
And when, you know, we're in Vegas. This is what, day 3, 4?
Yeah.
So it's day 3 in Vegas. This is responsible.
It's prophylactic.
Yeah. I don't know what that word means, but I agree. You know, when you're in Vegas, it's a lot of long nights, and the SHOT Show crud is the sickness that is passed around via handshakes and hugs and general mouth breathing.
And crop dusting.
And crop dusting. Yeah, crop dusting. There's a lot of that going on. All we're doing is fighting back.
We are.
And
we're taking the battle to the enemy right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, right now. It's as
we're being as aggressive as we can.
Yeah, it's definitely prophylactic. That's what we're doing. Your lovely co-editor at Recoil, your lovely editor Candace, is also a registered nurse.
She is delightful.
And delightful for sure. So she hooked us up. And so now we're going to use our IV bags as a timer. When the bags are empty, the podcast comes to a close.
Yeah. I would like also to have a big shout out to Phoenix Fire Department.
Yeah.
Who supplied all of the gear for this one. So Phoenix at Hefty, you're great.
You're great. Thank you. Without you, we would be pale-faced, stumbling.
Yes, pale-faced, stumbling, hungover, and dehydrated.
And we've got B12 involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, suck it, vegans.
Yes. Suck it, vegans. You're the editor of Carnivore. We work for Meat Eater. So suck it, vegans, I think is implied, but we'll go right at him. Now, Cal, why did you not want to get hooked up to an IV?
Oh, you know, I'm just going with the old-fashioned way of having a tall can of beer here.
A light beer.
A light beer.
Doesn't dehydrate. It's like
water.
Either.
No. Yeah. That's right. Right, water. And yeah, ironically, we're all drinking beer now while the IV is flowing. So does that counteract does that in any way counteract the IV experience to be drinking?
You're going to have to definitely piss.
During this?
Yeah, maybe. For sure.
Oh, wow. Okay. Would you? Mine's going fast. Mine's going too fast. Candace is slowing down my IV because it's going too fast.
Otherwise, we're not going to have. We're going to get halfway through a story, Ben, and then we just have to go.
Yeah, your nose is running.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to slow these babies down because we got to go an hour or two here. Mine's already really. It feels cold. Does yours feel cold?
No, I'm feeling pretty good now.
I'm so cold.
Hold me.
Hold me.
Hold me.
It's like, oh, the position.
Yeah.
Ian's position is all messed up.
Yeah, I'm cutting it off.
Well, this is great. I'm happy we're doing this. I'm sure it's entertaining for the listeners. Cal?
Yes, sir.
Will you at least take a shot of B12 or something?
Yeah, absolutely.
You would do that?
Yeah, that worked for me last year, DC.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I mean.
In my eye.
In your spread, yes. Taking shots of B12.
Are you sure it was B12? And are you sure? How was it administered?
Yes.
Well,
behind a dumpster
that looked like nurses, they were charging like $50. I found somebody behind the place for like $5.
Well, I had a friend of mine just text me that lives in Bozeman and said, like, we should start one of these IV hydration deals because you pay like $50. They're in Vegas.
Yeah.
And they'll come to your room. So maybe Candace could moonlight as that, but they'll come to your room and they'll hook you up, or you can go down there and they put you in, like we did it last year. They put you in a lounge chair and they turn on like Netflix and they just pump you full of whatever you've paid for them to administer. It's fantastic. So maybe that's a secondary business.
You think Bozeman would support it?
I don't know. Maybe Phoenix would.
Yeah. I mean, Phoenix Metro is big enough to support it, but one thing I don't like about Phoenix is everything is so spread out. You know, it takes you an hour and a half to drive
to go
from
anywhere.
One end to the other. So would that be economically viable? I mean, you'd have to factor in that time,
well,
and mileage.
I think we can do it. Yeah. Bozeman, everything's about 15 minutes away.
Well, big part of this, too, is, you know, you got your high endurance athlete crowd around, too.
Oh,
they'd
yeah.
probably be into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially B12.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
But,
and you'd have to say it's artisanal.
Oh yeah, it's artisanal.
Farm to vein.
Farm to vein.
This is all non-GMO. It's gluten-free. B12.
Yes.
Well, we were talking before the podcast that where Ian and I met, and I feel like, you know, I've been in the industry for, you know, like 11 years, maybe something 10 years, and Ian was like maybe the first person that I met outside of the walls of the NRA where I worked at the time.
Huh. If I'd known that.
You would never. No, I would tell you this relationship would be over.
Exactly.
Ian was on a show called Top Shot.
Indeed.
And tell us about that show, Ian.
So, reality-based competition format shooting show, which doesn't sound like those words should ever go together. But they managed 5 seasons out of it. And
they
did a good job of bringing the shooting sports to a wider audience. So... Yeah, I have to thank everybody who was involved with that and allowing me to bridge over from what I was doing before and into the shooting industry. And I Forrest Gumped my way entirely through it. I'm not qualified to do anything of the things that I've been doing for the last 20 years. So this is just one more thing that I was not qualified to do.
And what year was this that you won?
This was 2010, believe
2010.
It or not, Ben.
Yes.
This is 9 years ago.
9 years ago.
Yeah.
People don't even know. Kids that today don't even know about Top Shot.
I know.
There's 9-year, 10-year-old kids running around that have never seen it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I'll have to do reruns.
But it was 5 seasons, and you were the first champion, and then you were appeared on other show, other seasons, right?
Yeah, like yeah. I came back on every season after that as either an expert. Again, well, I was not qualified to do so.
Are there any clips around of this? Like when like the it was the History Channel that aired it. So it was, like you said, it was a mainstream. You know, at the time, I'm working at the NRA as an editor for American Hunter, American Rifleman, and we're looking for mainstream, you know, acceptance of guns and gun culture, and and it really was that, right? I mean,
absolutely,
it was.
And it spawned a bunch of other sort of Me Too firearms-related reality shows, which, and I'm pleased to say that I think Top Shot is the only firearms-related reality TV show that did not result in a criminal conviction at the end of the season.
You're right. I was a part of another one of those.
Oh, what was that?
So there were various other ones, like I think Sons of Guns.
Sons of Guns. Yeah. I knew that family very well.
Yeah.
And I actually had also, I wrote an article, a feature article on your life and your win for American Rifleman, and then Sons of Guns came out, and I did the same for those guys. You know, that was maybe my beat at the time. And your story works out well. Story of Sons of Guns, the television show from Discovery Channel.
Perhaps not properly vetted individuals.
Yeah, I would say that's probably the case. There was a little bit of some improper things going on in the Red Jacket gun shop.
Yeah.
And so that is long since defunct, and some folks are in jail.
And absolutely justifiably so.
Absolutely justifiably so. I don't want to talk about the. You can look it up. You can look up all. Google that and read it. We don't need to cover that here. But there was another show after that where a similar thing. What was it? We don't even need to say the show.
Yeah, that was in Colorado, based out of Colorado.
Another show.
That dude went down.
Mm-hmm. For other nefarious acts. And so, but you and your fellow Top Shotters, because I see a lot of them walking around here, man. Like
there
you guys,
were a bunch of them.
Back in the day, man, you guys had, it was like a family.
Yeah.
From that show.
Yeah, in fact, I saw one of them this morning. And Chris Serino remains one of my longest standing friends in the firearms industry. And he was my rival, the last dude standing in season one. And we went head to head and, you know, I won, he lost. And we've remained great friends ever since. And he was staying at my house just last week.
Yeah, man, it's super. It's interesting because you know it's a reality TV show. It's a production for television. But I remember from those years, like you guys were tight. You would show up at the trade shows, and it was a real thing.
Yeah, I met up with JJ Ricaza, another champion, and that guy's been crushing it. He's a beast. He's an athlete. He's somebody that children should look up to, because JJ is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And ran into him at range day on Monday. And
you're going to look up to Ian, you should at least be an adult, not a child.
Yeah, I'm probably the worst example of humanity your children will ever meet. But JJ, on the other hand, he's a prince among men.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that was an interesting time. And so that's when we met, because I watched the show and thought, here's a person that. And then I heard a little bit about your story, and I was like, wow, here's a person that needs to be highlighted. And so we did, right? You came to...
Yeah, I came to NRA HQ and did the interview with your good self. And as a result of that, and a chance meeting with Mark Keefe in a corridor, and he asked me, what do you want to do now? And I said, well, I kind of want to go over in the firearms industry full time. And he said, let me make a phone call. And as a result of that, and I'm eternally grateful to Mark for that, but as a result of that, I ended up working at Crimson Trace for 2 years as their PR guy.
Hey, I've been taking credit for that all this time.
You've been taking credit?
Yeah, I've been telling people, like, Ian got to start because I...
Well, indirectly. I mean, you got me there. And
I set up that
meeting with Mark, but Mark was the one.
I took you to the hallway.
You did.
I said, the bathroom's down there, Ian. And you were headed there.
Talk to everybody you can.
Yeah. If you see a guy, it looks important. Talk to him. So, I'm...
And where were you?
Sage advice.
Where were you at 2010? Were you a U.S. citizen?
Not quite. I was working in the construction industry, and I started off as a timber framer in the construction industry, and then rose through the ranks in that, and then ended up being general manager of the company that I was working for. And then they kind of gave me a checkbook and said, go west, young man, establish a new branch of this organization I was working for in the Portland, Oregon area, and did that. And then while I was there, went on to Top Shot, auditioned for that, then went through that whole sorted process, and then came out the other end, and apparently I managed to get through it without people discovering my entirely, you know, my gross lack of skill. So I bluffed my way through that, and then Ben invited me to the NRA headquarters, and editor-in-chief of American Rifleman, Mark Keefe, made a phone call on my behalf and hooked me up with Crimson Trace, who are a great company in the Northwest.
Yeah.
We're staffed with some fantastic people. And the founder of the company, Lou Danielson, is like everybody's crazy uncle. He's
Lou is like the
he is larger than life. I was trying to find him this week, but the dude is, you say, it's like everybody's crazy uncle who goes and tinkers and invents things, and he's just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And there are lots and lots of Lou stories. And and as a result of that, I was in the right place at the right time when my current gig with Recoil, they needed a new editor-in-chief, and I thought, maybe I could do that. I mean, nobody told me I couldn't.
No, so, yeah. Nobody seems to have instructed you up to this point. But yeah, I was going into marketing at the time. I had been an editor and then went to Peterson Tunning and been an editor there, and then I was going into marketing when you were going from marketing into editorial.
Yeah, editorial, yeah. Yeah, yeah, so who's the biggest whore?
Oh, me. Maybe, yeah. Anyway, if anybody's listening to this and wants to give me free gear, I'm in. So you spent some time, it's an interesting turn, like for how I think the your life preceding Top Shot and our meeting and your conversation with Mark was even probably more interesting, but that's an interesting turn to where you are today. From a reality TV show, and I remember just being like, this dude's in construction, former British military. He wins a reality show, and now he's doing what he loves to do in a country where he's allowed to do it. Like it's
yeah, it's pretty much the American dream.
Yeah,
you know, and for any detractors of this great nation, I would say that first off, get your head out of your ass, and it's just like, this is the one place on earth that I know that offers those kind of opportunities. But if you want to seize them, then that's all down to you. You can't just sit in your ass and let them, expect things to be handed to you on a plate. And like I say, I've been phenomenally lucky, but at the same time, I haven't just coasted through it.
Yeah. No, you work hard and you get there. And what's, explain your current gig.
Okay, so current gig is I'm the editor-in-chief of Recoil magazine. And, that's how I started out. Recoil is, I don't know, how would we describe Recoil? Yeah. Candace, how would we describe Recoil?
The most honest, but also the most visually captivating gun magazine.
The most honest and visually captivating gun magazine based out of Phoenix. No, that was
in the country. I wouldn't say just based out of Phoenix. Well, we were based out of LA, but
in LA,
that has changed, but I'll touch on that in a minute.
Yeah.
So Recoil was founded in, I think, 2011, if I remember correctly. And the whole premise of it was that a bunch of really smart dudes got together and sort of looked at the marketplace at the time. And in publishing, I'm publishing background, and they decided that, there's an awful lot of gun magazines out there, and most of them are shite. And they decided to create their own, and by doing so, kind of set the bar in terms of certainly graphic layout and quality of photography. And so that was kind of it to start off with. And since then, let me back up a little bit. So Recoil Issue 1 was launched at SHOT Show 2011, and then it was an SIP, so a special interest publication, so it was a one-off at that point, and they're kind of testing the waters just to see if it would fly, and it did. So more issues were created. And it was then became a biannual publication. And then subsequently, when I took it over, it was kind of, you know, okay, it's going to be a quarterly, something like that. But by issue four, because it was created out of California by guys who were kind of tied into the Californian firearms scene, which is not perhaps the most vigorous.
We'll call that an oxymoron.
Yeah. They kind of ended up saying some things that they probably shouldn't have done. And as a result of that, it was kind of an object lesson as to how to ruin a brand over the course of a weekend. And I then had the opportunity to step in and sort of rescue it. And since then, managed to get a great team. Hired some really dedicated and sort of creative individuals, and hiring and managing creatives, as you well know,
yes,
has its own set of hazards,
its own set of challenges.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a box of fireworks exploding at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Lots of things happening.
Lots of things happening. Many different directions.
Yep. Well, explain to people how, like, what your because we're in the media world here, so we can talk about it all day. But for folks who don't know, the general, like, you read Field & Stream, you read Pearson's Hunting, what's happening there is the advertising is running the ship.
Yeah. There are two business models in this industry.
Yeah, explain those and give people an idea what you are doing.
And I you know, I'm not judgmental as to which one is better.
No.
The one that we operate on is that in my most important client, the one guy that I or girl that I have to satisfy, is the person who goes to the local newsstand and stumps up $9, because we have a $9 cover price. It's a, you know, it's an expensive magazine, and they put down $9 of their hard earned cash every couple of months in order to buy an issue. That is the person that I write for. There is another business model which is prevalent and preeminent in the industry and has worked very well over the past few decades. And that in that one, you kind of look at what the numbers are. So if I'm offering, say, a 2-year subscription at $12.99, you kind of figure, okay, that doesn't really cover the cost of ink,
anything,
postage,
anything.
And I, you know, if I was a writer working for that magazine and you know, all of my income was funded from the cover price at a subscription of 24 issues at $12.99, then I wouldn't be getting out of bed.
No.
In that case, okay, how did that, how does that publication make money? Well, it's advertising driven. So you pump up your circulation numbers so that you can go to advertisers and say, okay, I'm reaching, say, 500,000 people. And advertisers go, okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's based on what they call a CPM.
Cost per impression.
And it's, you know, per times 1,000, basically.
Yep.
And those folks are, like you said, a cheaper subscription means generally more subscribers,
more,
which means you can charge an advertiser more for those more eyeballs. It's
exactly.
Super simple.
So your page price per advert within the book is, you know, you can charge more for it, and that's what covers your overheads, and that's what pays your writers, and that's what, you know, that contributes to your profits.
Yep.
And we're all in here, all in this business to make profit.
Yeah, and that's what it is, and there's no, you know, there's no shame in either way. I'm predisposed to working for the audience, you know, I've done, you know, obviously in my past been a part of a lot of different editorial operations, and I always have felt very strongly that the relationship with the reader, the one you're talking about, particularly in your case, you can, you know, exactly what that person, how that transaction happens. They go to the newsstand, they pick it up, they pay for it, they go home and they read it. I feel like that's the most important thing.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
You know, it's the most important. Yeah, 100% agree with that. And like I say, I'm not denigrating anybody else's business model, but that is the way that we do it.
Yeah, and there's just a motivation. And not saying that any other publication is driven by anything else other than the relationship with the audience, but there's a purity scale somewhere in there that says, you know, how does your business model inform your intent in some ways?
Agreed. Now, is it successful? Now, which one is the most successful at the moment? And I think what we've seen is a cultural shift over the last decade or so, and it's mainly been driven by digital content.
Yeah.
And the accessibility of other people's opinions online. Whereas now it's kind of, the audience recognizes that there is a pay-to-play element in a lot of print publications.
Yeah.
And that business model is, it's still around. It certainly is still around. But, you know, we have been successful operating on the other model.
Yeah. Well, and you think, like, the audience can sniff it out, right? I mean, Cal, you're, you know, you read and watch a lot of content. Like, can you?
Whoa, Cal reads?
Yeah, Cal can read. You read a lot of third grade.
It's a dirty
level.
Secret. It's a dirty secret.
You can tell when somebody's not altruistic in their editorial.
Man, it was like a heartbreaking moment. You know, years ago. You know, forking over some cash. When I was super, super into bow hunting, for the first time. So it's like the strongest that you'll ever experience something is when you're like diving in for the first time and really wanting to learn it.
Yeah, you're a convert at that point.
Yeah.
There's nobody more enthusiastic than a convert.
And I buy this magazine and it's, you know, it's like review of the year's, you know, best archery sites. I'm like, well, every fucking site is the best site on the market? Mm-hmm. Like, wait a minute. That can't be true.
But it must. It's in print. It must be true. Yeah, no, there has been. I mean, it's like we can be honest here. Like, there's been some degradation of the relationship between the reader and the writer. I mean, there has in the editorial product over the years, based on the business model where the advertiser pays the bills. I mean, it just has, and I'm not afraid to say it, and I know it to be true from being a part of it in a lot of ways. Again, it employs some of my best friends and people I know to be good folks and people I know to care about readers and care about information. So it doesn't always corrupt, but it has the ability
it's
to
there.
Do so.
It's ever there. Present.
Right. Yeah. And it's ever present. For sure. So what are you excited about recoil wise now? Like, do you, could you give us what's like the state of guns? What's the state of the industry right now? We don't.
Well, you say exactly about recoil. We've since grown recoil from one brand, one publication, which was a quarterly when I took it over, and we're now six times a year, so it's biannual. Sorry, bi-monthly. Slap me around the head, somebody. And then we've added titles, which have been a natural extension from our brand. So we then stood up a sort of prepper light magazine, which focuses on guys who not so much have their 40 acres and a mule out in the back country and are drying their own feces for fuel. Because, you know, those guys are already had stuff taped down. You know, they already know what they're talking about. But for people who are maybe in an urban area and want to get prepared for the next natural disaster, be it the fires in California or a hurricane or whatever. So that was the next publication that we stood up, and that's been successful and well-received. And then after that, we created a publication to cater to people who carry concealed weapons on a daily basis. And one of those is me. And after that, the one that we're most particularly excited about at the moment, myself and Nurse Candace over in the corner there, and that is Carnivore. And we kind of have the same philosophy, I think, with Meat Eater and Carnivore. Hey, there's a lot of crossover in the theme of the titles as well, in that... For example, and you contributed to the first issue as well.
I did, Ben. Yeah.
We are all about hunting, but hunting as an experience and hunting as not so much pursuing antlers, but definitely pursuing time afield with friends and family and putting high quality protein on the table.
Yeah.
And I do have to say, I don't know if you have it published somewhere where people can access it right now, but that your first issue, first letter from the editor is just a thing of beauty. Like the messaging in there is something people need to. Yeah, that's something people need to read before they hit the field.
Yeah, sometimes you need to speak bluntly about about this, about where we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Yeah, like, thanks.
No,
yeah. That's good. Yeah, and I think as well, because if we do that, if we take that approach, and we address it as this is the way that all of our ancestors have managed to put meat on the table. And as Steve Rinella said, and I use his quote all the time, not hunting is a particularly recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
As everybody before that, pre-industrial era, if you didn't hunt, then you're a weirdo.
Well, that's the numbers are. There's 100, and I every time I say this, I think it sounds wrong, but it's right. 100,000 generations of people lived on the hunter-gatherer diet prior to the Industrial Revolution. Like prior to the availability of industrialized foods. And then I think it's one or two generations in the industrial ages. And then you got to processed foods. And there's like a generation and a half, two generations of people that have lived, I think it's three now, that have lived in the processed food environment. And how quickly we've forgotten, or how quickly we've lost the knowledge of that exact fact.
It is. Know?
And that came from one of the doctors who founded the paleo diet. Mm-hmm. This is a guy saying, like, this is in your genes. You are experimenting in a way that...
Yeah. We've now normalized eating Cheetos.
Yeah.
And whereas previously it's like, you were going to eat... Yeah, I need to eat this. It's like, shake your head.
Yeah, no, we've normalized Cheetos. But yeah, I think that's the truth. I feel like a lot of times, because we care about this thing so much and we want people to understand what it is, we sound like a broken record. Like, listen, mm-hmm. this is us. Like, research your humanity and you will find, there's no doubt about it, you will find that someone in your past killed an animal and ate it.
Pretty sure.
A good friend of mine, old Greg Hedin, he used to, by way of... dating a gal, he spent a lot of time volunteering at a food shelter in South Idaho, Southern Idaho. And he was just shocked at how much food they could take in and how little food they could actually distribute, because people would show up and they, unless it is in a box, in a, basically pre-prepared way, They just don't have any clue that it is even food. So there could be a 30-pound bag of beans next to a 3 ounce, like, add water bag of beans, and they see one as food and the other is
ballast.
Yes.
Yeah. A pillow. You know?
Right.
A sandbag.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I throw that in the back of the truck during the winter season.
Well, yeah. Just try it, you know, just try one time. Like, if you know, anybody out there wants to try it, have somebody cook all your meals for a year. Don't touch the ingredients or the meals. Just take a year and don't do any work, any culinary work at all for yourself or your family and see how it changes you and your expectations, your perspective, like what food is to you changes. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never done that, but
yeah, it's not
like,
an experiment that I would want to inflict on.
But there's myself. A lot of people that do. God. There's a lot of college students that do. You know, there's a lot of people that's what they know. There's a lot of people that are quote unquote foodies that like to go out and have other people feed them. And that's what being a foodie is. You're like, yeah, but you're talking about the flavors. I'm talking about the work. Like, and that's
being involved.
Yeah. Being involved. So it's in a way scary, but in a way just like it's not going to stop. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not, you know, this conversation ain't going to put it to a halt. And so,
yeah, I think we need to be realistic to our expectations. There are only a certain number of people who will listen to that message and actually act on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's fine too, because, you know, I'm not going to judge other people's lifestyles, and there may be good reason for people to do that. You know, lack of time, family pressures, that sort of thing. But I think eventually, once those pressures change, perhaps that people might be more receptive to the message. And okay, go out and kill something and take it all the way through. From
slow food, man.
Man,
it's about the slowest food there is.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Like, not everybody's going to be able to go out and do that stuff for many, many, many reasons. But they also need to understand that is how this works. All of it works. And so they better damn well be cognizant of the fact that if they buy it in the grocery store, it does not mean that something didn't die.
Well, this I've been advocating this since like episode 2 of this program. I believe that we should do a deal where you have to get a license to buy meat. This means you're gonna like it.
Okay.
This meat.
Yeah, this is run by the government, right?
No.
this meat license is administered by some sort of government.
The government, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, fuck that.
It could be a state now. That could be like, I thought I had it. Listen.
It's in your King Supers card or your.
You have to go. So you go to, just like you get a driver's license, what you have to do is go to the meat. You have to go to like a factory farm and you have to take a knife and chop the head off a chicken, pluck that chicken, and like, you know, hang out with Mr. Purdue and cut it and vacuum seal it and send it off to everyone for everyone to eat. Once you've done that, they give you a little chicken license. And then when you go to the store, they're like, sir, do you have your chicken license? And you're like, yes, here. It's a little laminated card with a picture of you and a dead chicken. And you're like, here, I've got my chicken license. You're like, all right, perfect. You're allowed to buy chicken now. And if you'd like to buy a pig, you have to go whack a pig on the head. And if you would like to buy a cow, you know, beef, you have to have killed a cow.
I'm a cognizant meat consumer.
Now, there's a lot of holes in this. you've just called out one of them. A lot of people say I'm some kind of commie for wanting more government restriction. I'm not.
If anybody who's unfamiliar with my background, I was a shooter in the UK.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I'm running the show here.
Okay?
No. The reason I would say this, the reason I wanted you to come on the show is exactly what we're about to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I want to go line by line. I don't want to skip anything. Because like I said, your story that we've already covered after Top Shot was interesting. But the real interest comes prior. And the real perspective that you can provide comes prior to that.
Okay.
So you were born in what year?
I don't want to say because I'm so freaking ancient. I'm feeling so ancient.
You're getting old, huh? Yeah, you'll die before
2 pounds,
sure.
14 ounces. 2 pounds. Little baby Ian.
A little bit. Yeah. What do you first remember about life?
Oh, jeez.
You were born in what town?
I was born in the northeast of England. And I grew up there. Normal
life?
Yeah, normal, happy childhood. And then one day, my folks had this little, with some of my other relatives, they had this sort of weekend place on a working farm, which I think is where I got introduced to the idea of, animals, they sort of end up on people's plates. It's actually, you know, there it is, walking around, and then subsequently, I'm eating steak. Make that connection. So, weekend place on a farm, and then managed to finagle away into convincing the farmer to let me shoot a 22, and that was it. It's like, oh, this is awesome. This is what I want to do for my entire life now. I want to shoot things. And as a result of that, went through the normal progression of a BB gun and then a shotgun, and then started competitive handgun shooting, and then went to school, joined the army, and I was a serving British infantry officer for 8 years. And then in 1997, the British government confiscated my handguns as a result of a school shooting. They changed the law and said, okay, anybody who's, you guys, you're all psycho lunatics. And even though you didn't do anything bad, you didn't do nothing wrong, but we're going to indulge in some collective punishment.
It was called the Dunblane.
Dunblane Massacre. And
similar to what, to school shootings that have happened in recent vintage in America.
Indeed. And so because that happened in an election year, the two political parties were vying to outdo each other in terms of restricting people's liberties and throwing the firearms community under the bus as a scapegoat for the actions of a lunatic. And they decided that, collective punishment was in order. So they confiscated mine and about 20,000 other people's lawfully held firearms. And as a result of that...
Yeah, describe the day that you had to...
I got to jump in here 1 second,
too. Yeah, please.
Because the only other time I've heard this story, Ian and I had just butchered a black bear, and we were literally in
elbows deep.
Yeah, in the kitchen. I mean, getting that meat prepared to feed 13 people.
Yeah,
and really, that was like our only opportunity to just through the course of good kitchen talk, get to know each other a little bit, and the fascinating part to me is it was 20,000 people.
Yeah, so there were only that number of pistol shooters in a country of a population of, about 60 million at the time? And
there had been previous restrictions on
indeed,
long guns and things.
Yeah, but until 1923, there was no firearms laws, effectively no firearms laws in the UK.
Wow.
You could walk into a hardware store and buy a machine gun before then.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was in 1923, because of after the end of the First World War and the mismanagement of the veteran population returning from that, the Bolshevik Revolution actually started getting a toehold in the UK.
Mm.
And so, cast your minds back to what happened then, that time in history. So you have a large working class population which had been used as cannon fodder for 4 years. And they came back to a country that kind of did not appreciate what they'd done, what they'd been through, and straight into the opening phases of the Great Depression. And so, the Bolshevik message was being accepted and had a ready audience at that time. So as a result of that, the British government and establishment decided that, okay, and in the wording of the cabinet minister at the time, they wanted to ensure that firearms were available to friends of the government.
Oh.
And as a result of that, they instituted the first firearms restrictions in the United Kingdom. And like I said, prior to that, you could walk into a hardware store and buy a machine gun. And it's a story that is very, very rarely told. And, armed crime as a result, because of that, let me backtrack. So, that was the first firearms restrictions, and that sort of kind of set the scene for every subsequent incremental increase in screwing with guys' right to own firearms. And we went all the way through up to the 1968, I believe, restrictions on shotguns, and it was just sort of just drip, 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 chipping away at people's firearms rights. And as a result now, there's very, very little in the way of firearms ownership in the UK. It's regarded as some sort of cultural aberration.
Mm.
And
but at the point at which you had to turn in, you had two pistols at that point?
No, I had a veritable smorgasbord of handguns. Oh, okay. I was a competitive pistol shooter.
You were a competitive pistol shooter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were like 20,000 licensed.
But by that time, there were only about 20,000 people who were licensed to own handguns. I mean, you could license to own shotguns, license to own long rifles.
And so because of that, these two political parties, they're like,
oh, 20,000 people? Okay, under the bus you go.
Yeah, do the math.
Yeah.
We could win the election. These 20,000 people don't matter.
Yeah, they don't matter. There's no blip on anybody's radar.
Yeah.
And so we were sacrificed. And and they say they were trying to outdo each other. So Tony Blair, to his, don't get me started on that motherfucker.
no, that's why we're here. We want to get you started on that motherfucker.
So, yeah, so he decided at the point that the firearms, new laws were created, 22 pistols were exempt. And so he went, that's an opening. That's a vulnerability to the Tory establishment. And so he went, we need to ban 22 handguns as well.
Wow.
So that was added. That was subsequently added. So there was, when this firearms legislation was enacted, there was a grace period. And the government said, okay, well, you have to hand them all in. And initially, the way it was, the law was drafted was there was no compensation whatsoever. And he's just like, hand over your property. And that produced a bit of a backlash in the House of Lords. And subsequently, the government revisited the legislation and said, okay, well, we're going to compensate you for it at fair market value. So if you just destroyed the market for something, what's the fair market value?
You can't have them. No one can have them. So they're worthless. We'll give you $5.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. But, you know, shooters are resourceful people. So we found ways to game the system. And you had about 6 months, if I remember rightly, to from the passage of the law to the point where you were looking at a 10 stretch in pound me in the ass prison. If you didn't hand over your guns.
It's a weird name for a prison, Ian.
Her Majesty's pound me in the ass prison.
Yes.
And
you're still active military this time.
Yeah, yes? So it's still active military at the time.
You're a competitive shooter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's set this up for folks. You're a competitive shooter. You're active military.
Yep.
But yet...
And yet the government decided that, despite the fact that when you go to work, you have all of these instruments of destruction, you're not fit, worthy, or trustworthy enough in order to have a handgun in your home. Because somebody else...
might break a law that you are following.
Exactly. Exactly. And then last time I checked, even in the UK, murder is illegal.
Yes.
There you go.
I'll Google it, but I'm gonna go with yes on that one. But yeah, I mean that's so you experienced that. And what year? Give people
that was in 1997.
1997.
Yeah, late 1997. So at the end of this 6 month grace period, the very last day, I went down to my local police station wearing uniform and handed over my guns, and then went back to work, and then checked out machine guns from the armory, and then went back and did my thing.
And what's the feeling like? I mean, give people a window into, I could guess, angry. What are you feeling when you're turning those guns in? And like, what's the conversation? What's the experience in the police station? Like, take people into what that might feel like.
The cop who took possession of them, he realized that the absurdity of the situation. But nonetheless, it's his job. Took my guns off me and gave me a receipt for them, and we shook hands, and then I left for the United States.
Yeah, and you flew to America.
Yeah,
yeah. How long until you?
It took about 6 months after that, and then just to finalize the sort of move. But yeah, I resigned my commission and said, "No, fuck you guys. If you can't trust me with guns, then I don't want to be a citizen here anymore." So moved to the U.S.
Follow the dream.
Yep, follow the dream. And as a result, perhaps I'm more pro-2A, more rabidly pro-2A than the majority of people in the United States, but I've experienced it firsthand.
There's a lot of people that are on the left or would like to restrict gun ownership in this country that will say, and have said to me, and I'm sure said to you, no one wants to take all your guns. That will never happen. Yeah, but like, we're not going to take all your guns. We just want to take a few of them.
Yeah, well, I've experienced it firsthand. So from about the early part of the 20th century through the end of the, not even the end of the 20th century, they say there's no firearms restrictions, and it's just an incremental chip away. And here's the next, everybody wants just common sense gun laws. That's all we want, is common sense gun laws. Well, guess what happens? The next stage is registration or backdoor registration. And once that happens, it's just like, okay, we know what you have. Hand them in.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's examples of that in Australia. There's examples of that in England.
And California.
And California.
Yeah.
So let's just defunct that right now. This has happened elsewhere. And we don't want it to happen to us.
Exactly.
Like, and that's what we go to work to do.
Right. So the editorial stance that we have is not one fucking inch. Well, I'm not compromising.
And you have,
and I look at you, and I know that.
And you have the experience to back it up.
Yeah,
I mean experience to back it up. And now, and you look at the UK now, you look at England now. They are looking to. I'm not sure how much you've read. I'm sure you have looking to restrict knife ownership.
There has always been, that undercurrent of restricting anything that could possibly be used in a self-defense scenario. The government wishes to monopolize the use of violence.
Yeah.
And like it or not, violence is a fact of life.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, when I wrote this story for American Rifleman back in 2010, that's what struck me, is this like the dichotomy of, Candace is coming over to check the, his is not going.
It's going. It's not as fast as yours.
That's right. I got a bigger vein. That's what she was telling me.
You know what's interesting? Dude,
bear in mind, this is hooked to our arms.
But I still have a bigger face.
Squeezing the IV bag.
Yeah, okay. Cal, you're going to have to give play-by-play because I'm feeling a little dizzy, guys.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide-open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land? Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com. Use their store locator and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
My body's never had.
There's an interesting parallel, you know, to the meat talk that we were having at the beginning here is, you know, there's so much of the conversation that's driven by people who have no firsthand experience whatsoever. And I've had these conversations. I'm like, well, yeah, but what do you think of semi-automatic weapons? I'm like, well, let me just tell you what semi-automatic weapons are. Like, yeah, what's that okay, encompasses?
What do you understand by the term?
Semi-automatic weapon? Yeah. I have a friend, a very close friend, that says things like, guns are made to kill. And that's the difference between guns and cars. Because I'm always like, well, what's the difference between driving a car into a crowd and taking a gun out? He's like, guns are made to kill. I'm like, it's like, listen, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Guns are made to shoot.
Guns are meant to expel a projectile.
Yes.
What you use that projectile for is entirely down to the user.
Yeah, what it hits when it gets to this terminal impact is up to the user. Where the car drives, whether it's on the road, in between the lines, the yellow and the white one, is up to the user. Where the bullet impacts is up to the user. And that is the fucking difference in that. So let's put that to bed. Like, and let's get that belief off the table. But yeah, and you're coming to America, like you said, and the dichotomy is there's a tragic event, right? There's immense sadness, there's shock, there's all, and then it spins, that goes away. We've seen this in the States. That goes away. It spins into a political fervor based on emotion most times.
Entirely based on emotion. And because you don't have the majority of the time, you don't have a perpetrator left to hang the blame on, because these nut jobs fucking off themselves nine times out of ten. Then, okay, so we're looking for a bad guy. We always look for the bad guy.
Yeah.
And you know, it's human nature to do so. So what can we blame? And so we blame an inanimate object. If you get your sustenance and your protein from the supermarket, and that's all that you have, that's all the only exposure that you have to it, then yeah, anything outside of that is looked as other and therefore threatening and therefore something that is icky. And
why would you do it any other way?
Yeah.
It's right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know,
I buy my meat on styrofoam trays because animals don't suffer because of it.
Yeah. Well, that's why your story is just, it didn't need to be about guns. It just was about like your pursuit of, as I would put it, or you would put it, freedom, like your freedom to express your enjoyment and your love and your passion for firearms in the most productive way for you, the people around you, and your life. Like,
yeah, I don't know. Basically, I'm not going to tell you how to live your life, so stick the fucking nose out of mine.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care, you know, I don't care who you sleep with as long as it's a consenting adult. You know, I have a lot of gay friends, and they say, okay, you're fighting for equality in marriage? You knock yourselves out. You make the mistake that I did.
Go for it. Jump in that pool. I don't know. There's been some, as everyone listening to this will know, there's been some talk around the company I work for and this podcast and my voice and what I think around guns and the Second Amendment. And, you know, here's what I really think. Wow, man, I can't say what I really think because it would involve lots of cursing and yelling at a certain individual.
There's been a little bit of, you know, fucking and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we've said fuck about 40 times.
I mean, you might have to.
We're drinking beer in Vegas with IVs.
With IVs in our arms. I think we're entitled to do that.
Yeah, we shouldn't have any rules here. No rules. But I think I always try to look at these things with a pragmatic eye and be like, what about firearm ownership is the most important to me? And to me, it's defending my family. That's to me, but that doesn't have to be for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's just to me what it's about. And when someone says, why do you need an AR-15 to defend your family? I'm like, well, have you ever been a part of a natural disaster like I was in Illinois where they wiped it?
Illinois is a natural disaster.
Yes, it is. By living there, there was a tornado that came through and wiped out an entire town. And Bob Honeycutt, when I was working at Peterson's Hunting, one of my bosses there, Bob Honeycutt, who was the editor of Shotgun News, which is now Firearms News, his house was wiped off the fucking map. Like, just pieces, just rubble. And we went over to his house, and there was people coming in from urban areas like Peoria to loot this town, Washington, Illinois, that had been wiped off the map. And the folks who were defending their houses were doing so with AR-15s and all manner of firearms. So when you're in that position,
you want the most effective tool available to you.
So it's easy when you've never been in that position to say, let me limit the tools that are available to you to defend your house, your property, and your life in that situation.
Yep.
And that's where I got my, you know, my big dose of actual perspective when it came to that concept.
Yeah, well, if you don't have anything belt fed, then and I do.
Of course you do. Probably mounted to the back of a Jeep.
Then, an AR-15 is the next best, or semi-auto carbine that takes detachable magazines is perhaps your best tool for the job. And, okay, cool. And that might be something that only happens once in a lifetime as a natural disaster, but who the hell are you to tell me what I can and can't use?
Yeah. Yeah. Or where I can and can't go hunting.
Oh, yeah. Well,
either way.
Private property.
Yeah, who the hell are you? Tell me.
To pay taxes on this piece of land, to tell me I can't go in here and take the king's deer.
Yeah, there's a, I won't say the brand, Under Armour. They have a hashtag that says go where you don't belong. And it's about their hunting. It's a hunting hashtag they have. It says go where you don't belong. And I'm like,
next time I am bow hunting in somebody's backyard in Connecticut.
Yeah. I'll be like, what are you wearing? Wearing my Under Armour.
I've got, yeah.
That's why I'm good. I don't belong here. Well, check Instagram. That hashtag. That hashtag. So, yeah, you moved to America. And you moved to where in America?
Moved to the great state that permits perhaps the most firearms freedom at the moment because, you know, that's what you do. I moved to New York.
You're like out of the frying pan
and into the frying pan. But to its credit, New York does have some of the best deer hunting in the world. But
they do.
We don't tell anybody like that because, you know, there is again, from our perspective, there is a different story. There's a different narrative. You know, screw those guys. They're restricting all our gun rights. And yes, absolutely screw those guys for that. But you know, I've got some good friends that's still in New York, and there is some great, great deer hunting. And everybody thinks that, New York, are you going to go hunting in Central Park? Well, no, it's a pretty big place. And it offers a lot of diverse terrain from the, I love the Finger Lakes. That's where I was. And then the Adirondacks as well.
Beautiful country. That.
Beautiful country. And I actually went back. I went deer hunting in for the opening day of deer season.
I remember you telling me that,
I went to the Allegheny State Park this past deer season in November. And I took some buddies out of Phoenix who'd never been hunting before.
Awesome.
And introduced them to hunting on public land in perhaps one of the most populous states in the nation with the most restrictive gun rights. And I said, okay, well, maybe I'm doing this wrong, but this
how did they tell their friends about that? What'd you do this weekend? Well, I went with a British guy.
To New York. To hunt deer.
To hunt deer.
On public land.
With guns.
With guns.
And people's heads were exploding.
I mean, the reality is, though, that's a more realistic way to do it for most people, right? It's like, that's where the most people live.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's accessible.
Yeah. And it was, you know, the typical East Coast opening day experience. So a bunch of guys walking around in orange vests and, you know, it's fairly packed. You know, there is a lot of dudes in the woods out there. And so you have to walk a few miles in order to thin the crowds out. And yeah, we got into it, and we dropped a deer.
Sweet.
And hauled it back out, butchered it there at the cabin that we rented in this great state park. And I'm like, damn, am I just giving away my honey holes? And
It sounds like it's not a honey hole.
No, not really. But, you know, I got a little six-pointer, and butchered him that evening, and we did venison tartare and then venison stroganoff and washed it down with some fantastic wines from a buddy of mine who owns the best Riesling estate in the country right now. He's a great guy, and he is as dyed-in-the-wool liberal Democrat as possible. But, you know, he's a great friend, and we see eye to eye on hunting. We may not see eye to eye on politics.
But
and
you still talk to each other?
But we respect each other's...
You son of a bitch.
I know. It's like...
You're crazy. In this social media age, how is it possible to have friends that disagree with you on any subject?
I thought I knew you. I thought I knew you. This is where a distrust of the British come from.
Oh, I'm getting teary now.
Keep telling your story.
I guess we're good. Like, is a good illustration of how. Hunting. Just stop it, Ben. I think that's a good illustration of how hunting can transcend boundaries in both politics and ideology
and food and wine.
What you get? Food, get dudes, bunch of dudes with food, wine, fresh meat, cigars. Around a table who are just busting each other's balls and cracking jokes.
Unlike on social media farting. Where you're finding a reason to disagree.
Exactly.
In that environment, you find a reason to agree and have a good time and enjoy life.
Exactly. And everybody walked away from that as just, you know, best of friends. And that's how it should be. And we're all part of this great nation. And we, well, despite the fact that we may have differing views on certain policy issues, we're still Americans.
Yes.
We're taking a break from the podcast to appreciate this great nation. God, beautiful. From sea to shining sea.
No, you know, it's an odd thing to me though too, man. It seems like every strong dude with positive head on their shoulders can look somebody in the eye and have an actual conversation. We need a lot more of that right now.
Yeah. So that's what I would preach.
The numbers game, man. We better be willing to have a conversation because we're not going to win this game by breeding. We're not going to breed ourselves out of it, right? I'm not breeding a bunch of gun owners, you know. So
Cal's a non-breeder at this point.
Me too.
You're
me
a non-breeder too.
I'm a non-breeder. Yeah,
I've bred once,
and I'm talking, right? And I'm talking, and every day,
but there's
I get like, hey, man, I've done the research, been listening to you guys for a long time. I think squirrels and rabbits are going to be the only thing in my area that I can hunt. What should be my first firearm purchase? Not my last, my fifth or tenth was the very first one.
Yeah,
and that's it. Yeah.
Buy a fucking AR.
When you
just to piss people off, piss a politician off, you'll buy an AR.
But that's so. Here's where,
and a suppressor.
Here's where around the midterm elections we came kind of to a head, and I think it's interesting to get everybody's perspective on this. You have articulated well where you are, right? You're like, you have a very, what a lot of people would say is left-leaning. Are you peeing and we're having IV?
I'm going to pop here, babe.
What the fuck? We have IVs.
It's real quick.
Light beer. That's light beer. That's light beer.
How much do you have left in the can there, Ben?
Not a much.
Okay, because I may need to drain the main vein here.
You need to? All right. Well, I can't go on a soapbox with nobody else in the in the room. You wait until Callahan gets back, and then you go. Yeah, you have to carry your IV. So right now, according to the IV, we may have to speed the IV up. We've been going for like an hour and 13 minutes, and we're only halfway through the IV. We may bounce our entire afternoon. Candace, can you turn this thing up? Oh, am I wide open? Fine. No, I'm not mad about it. I like sit here and talk to my friends for a very long time.
So it's deceiving because it looks like it's half, but it's
he's deflated. Going faster than me.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have made fun of his vein size. Then he spent.
Yeah, you've stood next to me in a urinal.
Oh, I know. It's
hung like a Chinese fighting mouse.
Yeah, it's like this water's deep. Anyway, what was I saying?
I don't know.
This is so.
People going to listen to this?
Yeah, a lot of them do.
Really?
Yeah.
You guys need to.
This
get
one
a life.
Will, this one will be. This one will be. I have this predisposition, and this has happened recently, you know, and with this folks are challenging our belief in guns and such. And people also challenge our belief in hunting and like killing animals. So people are challenging from both sides, which
people are challenging.
The people are just challenging.
challenging.
But I've had this predisposition lately to see like a tough issue, which was what we're talking about. See a tough issue and just fucking run right at it. Sometimes get it wrong, sometimes get it right, but just run right at it. And then we can figure it out at some point. Hopefully. The conversation. You good?
Yeah, you get enough. You know, solid dudes around drinking enough beer. Then you, by the end of the evening, you've got everything squared away.
This is how stuff is figured out. All right, go pee. You got to pee, or are you going to hold it?
No. I'm going to hold it.
All right,
I'm going to hate you for it, but I'm going to hold it.
We'll have to. Yeah, there's only one bathroom here. So, anyways, listen.
That's a pretty big bottle.
Yeah,
And then a huge opening for a guy like you.
You can probably get it all the way in. Where are we at? We're about, what would we say, Candace? How far down the IV? How long do we have left, do you think, in the podcast? Because I don't want to wade into some other like healthy subject.
Yeah,
and then
I see what we call it, dude. I've got an interview from somebody who's going to throw the cat among the pigeons.
Throw the what on the pigeons?
The cat among the pigeons. It's an English term. You wouldn't understand.
Speak American, man.
One time he texted me and I was like, "What's up, man?" He's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Just hanging out." He's like, "I thought you might be in your wanking chariot." And I was like, "The fuck is that, bro?" I think it turned out to be my bed. Was that
your bed? Yeah, your bed is your wanking chariot.
Yeah. Oh, let's end the. All right. I got this now. Are we done with this heavy topic? Are we good? Like everybody said what they need to say.
I'm good.
Another chapter in the sordid saga.
So let's spin this. Give us some British terms. Some fucking like, we got the wanking chariot.
Yeah, so other terms for your...
Cat among the pigeons.
Yes.
Which means, I'm assuming, means like the predator among the prey.
Exactly. So okay. Feathers flying.
Yep.
Other terms, these are all, you know, British squatty terms.
Yes.
So other terms for your sleeping equipment would be your gonk sack.
Your gonk sack?
Yep. And the one that I'm most favored or most enamored of is if your sleeping bag is referred to as the horizontal time accelerator.
It's a little wordy for me, but I like it. Cal and I have a dual gonk sacks over there, and we'd be sleeping. I wake up and I look over during SHOT Show, and there's Cal. And I'm like, there he is.
Gonked out.
Mm-hmm. He's gonked out in the sack. What else? This is great. I'm sure you got a lot of this shit.
Oh, yeah. This
speaking with your better half, yeah. She's doing a little booth time at 1 o'clock that we need to make it to because she's way prettier than Ian.
She is. She's also more interesting.
She's like
more talented.
Yeah, when Ian's
talented, yeah.
Brother shows up, she's like, I can't understand a single word they say.
Well, yeah, we sort of lapse back into our northern dialect, which in the UK you can't travel more than 20 miles before somebody speaks a different accent to you. And so that's how we hate each other. we use that as a gauge. You say, he says he has a slightly different emphasis on the letter A, and therefore you must die.
Sounds like a lovely culture.
Yeah, well, we are the culture that did bring you concentration camps and the Boer War and football hooliganism. So
hooligans.
Yeah, football hooligans are real. I spent some time in Wales one time. I was in Cardiff, and we went to a football game, and people were just like,
"You didn't go to a rugby match?"
Yeah. It might have been a rugby match.
The rugby man.
It was a football game for sure, and we didn't
so
even make
rugby
it.
Football.
Oh, and don't come now.
Now there's football. So football is played with a round
football?
Ball.
Yeah, I
and,
know.
And rugby is like American football,
right.
But for men.
Do you guys wear pads? No. You call it rugby football.
Yeah,
and then football.
Yeah.
What else you got? What other?
We just got a ton of confusing stuff, and it just, you know, we have our own culture and dialects all over the country, and which serve only to confuse and befuddle people.
Yeah,
yeah. Like from the Northeast, where I'm from. A lot of our dialects are imported. You know, the British Empire was, you know, worldwide. So not a lot of people know that pajamas came from India.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you say in my neck of the woods, then if you say to, if you tell somebody I'm Ganyem, then you're going home.
You what now? Say that again.
I'm Ganyem.
Hmm. Spell it.
I'm not too sure I can.
When we were in bear camp, Ian's dish was curry. Made a big curry of sorts.
Yeah,
was it black bear curry?
Passanda.
Yeah. Yep, bear passanda.
Yep, and culture is the national dish of the of England.
Really,
yeah. That's what killed me. Like, it's like, well, I'm from the UK, so I'm making my national dish.
I'm like, I thought that was you just fried fish and fried potatoes, and then called it fish and chips.
Yes, that, and then there's the rest of it, which basically consists of boiled gray mush.
Yeah,
and people have this.
Is this lamb or is this chicken?
Going back to the UK.
Did you go back there a good bit, right?
I go there every year or so. And for the longest time after I moved over here, I was saying, okay, no way I'm going back to the UK. If anybody wants for my family to come visit, then they have to visit me in the US because I'm not giving any of my money to the British government because fuck those guys. And then, I kind of mellowed a little bit. And actually, this last year, I went hunting in the UK for the first time at like 35 minutes from the center of London. And it's possible. It is possible.
What'd you go hunting for?
Fallow.
Fallow?
Yeah.
Was there roe deer and things around?
Muntjac.
Oh, muntjac.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I shot a muntjac.
Muntjac is fanged deer?
Fanged deer. Possibly the smallest deer I've ever shot with a 270, which kind of...
Probably didn't get any meat off the front shoulders.
No.
Those blade roasts weren't looking very good.
Fortunately, I did thread the needle. I shot it right in the center of the chest, so the bullet probably expanded just inside the rib cage, but tenderloins were gone.
Whoa. After hunting coos deer, I got to hunt sika deer
mm-hmm.
and then coos deer within 4 months of each other. And I'm now very fascinated by small deer.
Yeah, the diminutive deer hunter.
Yes. The diminutive deer hunter. Yeah.
Ryan Callahan.
Yeah. Worked up some loads for my .22 long rifle.
I was going to suggest perhaps a 177 air rifle that you might want to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Whole new world.
Charge it up.
Yeah.
Go hunting.
Yep. So there were six deer species in the UK, and I've shot four of them so far. But this
Let's see if we can guess them.
Okay, guess the deer species.
Okay, cow. Can we guess the six deer species that are in white-tailed deer? Mule deer. No.
None of the above.
None of those. I'm going to go with roe deer being one of them. Fallow deer, which mm-hmm. we've already discussed. Muntjac being another. I'm going to also say that red deer is in there. That's obvious. Now we got two more to get.
Sika in
correct.
Sika deer.
Yep. One more.
We said fallow. We said...
Am I going to win this?
No. We're going to get this. It's not rusa deer. That's not it.
Come on, you can do this. Come on, Cal.
Cal's looking confused.
It's got to have strange teeth.
Yeah, it can't be just a normal deer.
Strange teeth? You mean English deer?
Yeah. That was a great joke.
Spike.
I'm thinking, we said roe deer, we said fallow deer.
Okay, I'll save you the agony. It's Chinese water deer.
I would have never got that. Yep. I was thinking rusa deer and other things.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah, so there's one of the few places in the world that you can hunt Chinese water deer, and the Chinese water deer population in China isn't doing all that well. So, it's a reservoir of those genetics.
Yeah,
cool. I've always wanted to come check things out.
How many of those are native?
Only three.
Three. Yeah.
And fallow are not native. They were imported from Europe in the time of the Normans.
Yeah.
Norman conquest.
Fallow deer, if I'm correct, are the most populated deer in the world. There's more fallow deer than any other type of deer, I believe.
I did not know that.
I was told that by a man.
Who should know.
Who would know. So I'm going to go with it. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. That could be the title of this podcast. Ben O'Brien.
If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But Ben O'Brien. We'll probably do very well. Well, we are coming to the end of our IV.
You know what that means, kids.
Kids, you know what that means. Here at the Hunting Collective, when the IV bag is empty...
It's time to go pee.
It's time to go and pee. Thank you, Ian, for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
What's how do you say goodbye in English?
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cheerio.
That's it. That's all. Episode number 47 is in the books. IVs, beer, all the best discussion with my good friend Ian Harrison and my good friend Ryan Callahan. It's a privilege to sit down with these boys and record, and I believe it's a great representation of Ian's life and what he feels and thinks, and ours as well. So hopefully you enjoyed it. I'm sure you will let us know your opinions on what was discussed, and we'll have a fun time with that conversation. In the meantime, as always, please go to themeateater.com, sign up for the newsletter, go to the store, go to the events page, do all those things. You're going to find us all over the country. In the next couple of weeks, we head out very soon to Reno and Sacramento. So those are the places you should be looking at and buying tickets for. So if you want to see Callahan, myself, Giannis Patelis, Steve Rinella, and other guests on the live podcast tour. We very much look forward to seeing you there, or seeing you anywhere for that matter. So that's it. That's all I got. Short, sweet, and beautiful. Again, thank you for listening. Thank you for wading into these deep waters and these important issues with us. Hopefully you find the conversation to be challenging. You find the conversation to be something that makes you think and makes you better. Because as Ian said and as Cal said during this podcast, the conversation is what we care about. So we'll keep having it next time on the Hunting Collective. See ya.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.